I'm Mark Caro, and this is episode 196 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. If you know this week's guest's work, you appreciate what a wonderful, smart, precise, observant writer he is. And if you don't know him, you're in for a treat. Welcome to Caro Pop, Peter Orner. Orner is the author of the justly acclaimed new novel, The Gossip Columnist's Daughter. It springs from actual characters and incidents, most significantly the apparent murder of Karen Cookie Cupsinet in 1963. She was the daughter of Chicago Sun-Times gossip columnist and TV personality Irv Cupsinet, widely known as Cup, and his wife Essie. Cookie Cupsinet's body was found in her West Hollywood home days after President Kennedy's assassination. No arrest ever was made. The narrator of The Gossip Columnist's Daughter, Jed Rosenthal, is an author whose grandparents, Lou and Babs, were close to the Cupsinets until the friendship mysteriously ended after Cookie's death. Like his narrator, Orner is an author who grew up in the Chicago suburb of Highland Park and has grandparents who were friends with the Cupsinets. The novel even contains photos purporting to show the fictional Lou and Babs with the Cupsinets, but may depict Orner's actual grandparents. As you'll hear in this conversation, Orner enjoys blurring these lines between fiction and fact and messing with us. My old Chicago Tribune colleague Christopher Borelli calls The Gossip Columnist's Daughter the most Chicago novel I've ever read. It certainly transports you back to an earlier era of this big city, when being a newspaper columnist and local television host got you rubbing elbows and even developing friendships with the likes of Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, Bob Hope, Sidney Poitier, and many others, including mob-connected fixers. What drove Orner to immerse himself in this past? Has he heard from people who knew the real-life figures portrayed, not always complimentarily, in his book? We also get into his writing style and approach. I've been a fan for a long time, appreciating how, whether he's writing short stories, novels, or essays, he makes every word count. Stories and chapters are short, narratives lean, zero fat. How did he get there? Orner is chair of the Department of English and Creative Writing at Dartmouth College, and we discuss what trends he's seen among his young writers. Full disclosure, like myself, Orner also is an alumnus of Camp Nabagamon way up in Wisconsin's North Woods. We don't actually talk about Camp Nabagamon here, but I wanted you to know. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Peter Orner. There's this impulse in reading the book to want to sort of check what's true, quote unquote, and not true. And I'm wondering whether, like, asking you about kind of the stories behind the story, is that a way of kind of ruining the spell the book casts, or is that fair game? Because, you know, obviously, you know, these people, most of these people exist in real life.
Yeah, I mean, I invited this onto myself, you know, and this isn't the first time I've done this. So
right.
It's territory that I know. I've written about, you know, from the point of view of Nathan Leopold in the past, you know. So, and I wrote a story about a temple shooting in Detroit that's based on a real incident. So I get it's a fair question, I think, in terms of just like, because I am mixing some basic facts with, you know, overwhelming majority fiction, but, you know, it's a true story, and Cookie Cupsinet existed, and she did die under somewhat mysterious circumstances in Los Angeles in November 63. So, yeah.
And there was a writer who wasn't born at that point who became a little obsessed with the story.
Sure. Yeah. And that writer's fictional, but he's certainly a cousin of mine.
There you go. But I mean, even the fact that you like drop these photos in there, which are kind of like, it's kind of funny, but it's also like, it's a little bit of a jolt to the reader where you have a picture of Babs, you know, with her eye being blocked by Cup's nose on page 402. And you're like, well, Babs is your invention. So is that your actual grandmother in a picture with Cup, or is that just something you found?
You know, again, I invite this on myself. I do.
This is why I was asked, sort of asking almost permission to ask this kind of question. Totally. If you don't want to answer them, don't. But
you know, I put it in the book, and so you know, it's fair game. You know, to me, that's Babs. In another reality, it may have been my actual grandmother. You know what I mean?
I was wondering if that was your actual grandmother. And there's the photo of Sidney Korshak on the stairs.
Yeah, that's, kind of in a real photo from the LA, I forget which paper, but yeah.
Right. Yeah. But you got Lou Rosenthal sort of on the side, who's ostensibly your grandfather. Now, was your grandfather actually there at that point, or is that just a different thing?
He may have been. I can't prove
Wow.
it. Yeah.
But you think it looks like him. You think that's him.
Could be.
I mean, how much do you like sort of messing with this idea and readers' idea of, what's fiction and what's nonfiction?
I any story, any fiction, any most, is I want people to believe, and I'm not the first writer to use real things in order to help that fictional world along, And so to me, it's all fiction, but I'm using real historical figures, famous people from another era to animate them in a piece of fiction. So to me, it's all part of the fiction, the fictionality, if that's a word,
Right.
to just try and, I was born many years after this incident, and so it's all imagined from my point of view. But because I was dealing with an era and real people, sure, I did a lot of research and I immersed myself in that universe of sort of Cups Column and being a man about town and having to be as your day job. Going out to get tidbits. I just thought, like, what a hilarious sort of remarkable way to make a living, like to go out and hobnob. I mean, that was basically Cup's job. But then the other part of the job, of course, was the hard work of putting that column together every day. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Cup and a lot of sort of reverence for the time and for the all the time he put in making that column. Maybe it wasn't the greatest literature on earth, but he was creating a like a community conversation through his work.
What was the line you have? It took a colossal amount of work to be that trivial for that long.
Yeah, I wondered if that line was unfair, and I actually the original line, I even think it's probably in the galley version, maybe, as I said, it took a lot of work to be so inane for that long. I thought inane was not accurate, actually. Trivial is more accurate, and I think inane was harsher, but the trivial things about pop culture are part of our history,
Right. I've
so
always thought so. I mean, the thing with Cup too is that what Cup did, like half the people on the internet are doing, there's just this
absolutely
totally everything sort of name dropping and oh, we saw this person at this restaurant and
right.
blah 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 blah. But that then, as you said, if you had to to get to the Chicago market, to go through Chicago, you had to go through Cup. And you didn't have all these other people who were gonna see you over at Gene and Georgette's or whatever.
Exactly. And I think that because everyone was reading him, it was like a common conversation. And that's so interesting to me. And I think I have a line in the book where I was a bag boy at Dominick's, so I spent a lot of time like listening to people in the checkout line. And I think probably as a kid, people, I've seen in the book where people are talking about something Cup wrote, another one of Elizabeth Taylor's divorces or something
Right.
like that. And that's the kind of stuff you'd hear, when you were bagging at Dominick's or Jewel or whatever. And so I just feel like there's something just kind of beautiful about that. And like you said, it's not any very different from what we see on the internet with influences in whatever. But it seems that like when it's only one guy, you know what I mean? Maybe it's Herb Cain in San Francisco, and it's I think the only bigger name than Cup in this world would be Walter Winchell, but he
Right.
was sort of I think, a more important figure in some ways. But
Well, he was working these political agendas too, which
yeah,
Cup
totally.
sort of stayed away from,
Yeah,
so.
Cup was, I think he certainly was friends with a lot of politicos and mixed it up and did get involved, and he was involved in civil rights and in a good way, but I think it wasn't his thing. His thing was, movie stars.
Right. So when this goes from something you're interested in, this journey that it takes in your head from, something you're curious about to a book, like what was the starting point that, you know, your grandparents' relationship with the Kupcinets and wondering what the hell happened there? Was it sort of hearing, you know, the story at some point later about, you know, Cookie Kupcinet being murdered or killed and or dying and wondering what that mystery was about? And did you sort of, when you started like looking into it, were you looking into it as research for a book, or were you just looking into it because you're interested? But, or maybe as a writer, there's no distinction there.
Yeah, I mean, this has been a story that's kicked around my family and my brain for a long time. You know, there was a friendship between my grandparents and the Cups. That friendship did end. That's all I know. It wasn't ever discussed. And so I've written about this before in different ways. But so it's just always been a story. You know, they say, some writers say, you know, we only have a few stories we tell. You know what I mean? And I circle around, you know, family stories, and I tell them and I retell them. And this time I thought, you know what? This world is so interesting to me because I've just been so immersed in it for so long in my memory and then starting to do research about it. I thought, I'm going to use the real figures as opposed to invent other famous people to stand in for the famous people I'm writing about, right? And so I had a fictional family, the Rosenthals, but I wanted to, you know, I thought, as doing research about Irv Kupcinet and his wife, Essie, and also the death of Cookie, I thought, you know what, I'm going to use a real case, a real situation, and see if I can rotate a fictional story around it. And that was... That was what I did, but it was something that was on my mind for many years. But yeah, the colonel was there was a friendship. My grandparents were friendly with the Cubs, and at one time pretty close, including my own grandfather being the captain of the fishing trip. He'd be the captain of the Cup. Had a famous annual fishing trip that he would talk a lot about in the column. My grandfather was in World War II, he was a captain of a ship, an LST in the South Pacific. So he knew his way around boats. And so he was the captain of that expedition. And, you know, the Cup had a lot of jokey columns. And one of the columns was about how my grandfather refused to allow women on that trip, you know, and by orders of the commander being my grandfather. So, you know, that's out there in terms of that family connection. I was also in Cup's column myself, I think once, maybe even twice, for my early stuff, which I was very appreciative for.
Right.
So, you know, there was a kernel of a connection, and that was something that was made me curious. And then I kind of launched the fiction that way.
And you were a stringer at the Sun-Times for a while for sports guy. So you saw him. I mean, did you say, hey, Cup, you were pals with my grandparents until you weren't?
Sure. I mean, I'd met Cup a few times through my father, and I would certainly see him in the hall when I was in the building. Usually as a stringer, I was at the games, and I would call in the scores from a payphone to Taylor Bell at the high school sports desk. And he would kind of write the story while I was narrating it to him. And it was a pretty interesting way to kind of learn how to write. Like, he'd be like, I don't like that adjective, tell me something else. And like, you know, I'd be describing a touchdown and I wouldn't be able to do it, you know, kind of succinctly enough for him. So it was sort of like learning how to write on the telephone with this editor screaming at you. It was kind of an interesting moment in my life. I was a high school kid, you know.
Wow. But and then you would see Cup and you knew he had some family connection at that point.
Yeah. There's sort of like this family connection. Sure. And my father, and this is sort of in the book, and, you know, I sort of fictionalize it, but my father did stay in touch with Cup, whereas my grandparents did not. And so that was also a way that we would see him around town. And so,
right. And obviously in the fictionalized version, they're very close, including being sort of the primary people kind of, you know, supporting them, mourning with them when their daughter dies, and even, you know, accompanying him on this trip to LA to retrieve the body, which sounds like is maybe what actually happened, depending on whether we believe that that's that the actual grandfather in that photo with Sidney Korshak.
That's fiction, but you know, did Cup go to Chicago with friends and a lawyer? Yeah, he did.
LA.
So, as far as I understand from the research I've done. Yeah. So, but again, it was all sort of, you know, kind of imagined scenes. I know the book opens with kind of a scene of them landing in Los Angeles after a long, after a flight in the I guess it was a morning flight, but anyway, they end up being in Los Angeles on December 1st, about 2 days after Karen Cupston's body was found. And I tried to imagine my way into that horrific, how what could be worse in your life than having to make that trip.
And then you have Solly, the brother who Lou's brother, who's sort of this enigmatic, quietly compelling figure throughout the book. I mean, was there? I don't know. See, this is the thing. It feels so reductive if I'm like, was there really a brother like that, or did you, like? And that's the problem, because I don't want to turn what you did, because what you did is pretty magical, and I don't want to kind of like be like, that dissect, when you dissect the frog or a joke, you sort of kill both of them or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, but also, like, what my fictional my hero in writing is the Russian writer Isaac Babel, and Babel once famously said that he didn't make anything up ever. Now, it's not true exactly, but
He made that up.
he used real things in order to create his fiction, and that's so, did I come across a tidbit somewhere that Cup had obviously gone to Los Angeles to pick up his daughter's body, which is, what you would have to do, right, if you're a father in that time. So I just had that scene in my head, trying to imagine it. But in terms of the Solly character, no, I mean, he's a figment of my brain, but there was I had an uncle who worked at the post office. His name was Uncle Harry, and he was just one of these people who kind of was in and out of our lives. And not really, kind of like one of these people, and I think every family has these, a peripheral family member
Right.
who kind of like,
I think every family does have those, by the
yeah.
way.
And even like, and it's weird because, Uncle Harry lived in Chicago. He was close. So every once in a while, he'd show up on a Thanksgiving. I've written about like the Uncle Harry. Like, I've written nonfiction about Uncle Harry because he disappeared from our radar. And so we didn't actually know when he died. Things like that, like a strange, these strange stories, of people, loners within your family. And Solly was sort of based on that idea, is somebody who is very much on their own, even though they're very close to you. And I was very intrigued by that. So, and like, yeah, like you say, everyone families has them. And so in this book, it's Solly.
I mean, part of the drive in this book also feels like I'm a few years older than you are, and I think you get to a point where the kind of generations are passing along, and you start thinking, you have these questions about your family, and you're like, well, wait, well, what happened here, and there are these big sort of gaps that that you're filling in as a fiction writer, and also just someone who's insightful and doing actual research into it. But there's also this undercurrent of, that some things are just ultimately unknowable. And we're so used to in fiction there being bows tied around everything at the end. And the way you structure this, you sort of set up this mystery, but it's also like it's not a mystery, and it is a mystery, but the mystery is sort of how unknowable we all are at the end. So I don't even know if there's a question there, but that's.
No, I mean, I appreciate it very much, and I'm with you on this. These gaps, and the questions that, I think a lot of my work has to do with questions I didn't ask. Either because I was too young and didn't know to ask, or I was too shy, or I knew, in my grandparents' case, they didn't want to talk about certain things. And I, in a lot of ways, this book is about stories that weren't told. It was there was edges of it that was told, but not the story that I tell, because it was sort of suppressed, whatever story there was. And so I think you're right. I mean, I think that's what I mine in fiction, is these sort of like these gaps between what we know, and what we don't know. And like, so much, it's so weird how even, two, three generations, we lose these stories, I mean, my great grandfather, I've written about him, just but try to imagine, he was a bookbinder on the north side. I think he lived in Dearborn Park, I think, street. And what was that life like? He died very, very young. So my grandmother barely remember her own father, but loved him very much. But he died young enough for her not to have that many memories of him. So it's like an entire life, kind of forgotten. And but he's somebody who's haunted me for years, my great grandfather Lou. And so this book is just one of those, another attempt to sort of answer something that, that I was never going to get a real answer for.
Right. I mean, so you told Chicago Magazine, this book has been in my head for probably 20 years, and it took me 15 years to write because, one, I'm slow, and two, I couldn't figure out a way to tell it.
Yeah.
What was the thing that enabled you to figure out how to tell it?
I've been thinking about that. I think I you mentioned Sally. It's weird because Sally was this character who's not essential to like the plot of the book, the essential core of the mystery of it. But he's somebody who kind of just stuck around in my head. And when I was stuck, I would think about him, and what he had to do with this. And he was, as you sort of alluded to, he's the brother of the best friend, and he's the bodyguard of Irv Kupcinet when he goes to Hollywood to pick up his daughter's body. And for some reason, that character, just that kind of almost like the protector figure, he's kind of watching that character. It like kind of helped me like move the story forward. And I realized that even though he was a minor character, and I think I say this very early on, he was sort of the beating heart of the book in some ways, and that helped me. But like anything else with a long book, you just got to hang in there. And I think at a certain point I realized that I just had to hang in there, and just be with these people for as long as it was going to take. And that's what happened. But it this book took a long time. I mean, this was not an easy one for me. I'm not exactly sure why, but I think it had to do with the structural complications and the fact that there was a present day narration and a 1963 narration and then everything in between. So I had a lot of time to handle.
Right. Well, and you tend to the chapters and your stories, for that matter, they tend to be these short bursts. I mean, like you like short chapters, you like short stories that are really short,
Right.
and it's almost like these kind of snapshots that are flashing in front of you, and then they come in and then they go out, and then you go on to the next one. And I'm wondering, in the writing of this, in a way, is it sort of like you're almost like, doing the index cards of like, some screenplay on the board behind you or something like that. You're writing these, these things, and you're sort of piecing them together later, or rather it's really like, even though the storytelling isn't linear, you're sort of writing it from beginning to end.
Yeah, I mean, this was all over the place. I'm not in my I'm in my closet office at home, but in my studio, which I have across the river, I just have all this stuff on the wall. I have this picture's actually in the book, my real desk, the wall. But I had just, I had so much disparate research and photographs and things I just was looking at to sort of inspire me and think about this maps of Chicago and all this stuff. And so I tend to just sort of maybe cue in on something. There's a sort of minor story about S.E. Kupcinet writing an essay in a New York newspaper about the death of famous actress. Now I'm forgetting her name. I don't have the book in front of me, but anyway, it's just like I was only because I was just happened to be looking at that story tacked to the wall. I was like, well, maybe that somehow fits in. So it was sort of visual. Like I would like look at something and then I'd like, oh, maybe I can take a note on that and figure out how the story could sort of move forward that way. But it was a lot of stopping and starting and a lot of, definitely non-linear, as you say.
What is it about the short units that you like as a writer?
Oh, that's a great question.
I mean, and for you, it's like a big obvious question. You've probably been asked it a lot too,
Yeah,
but
no, I don't think I have actually.
well, what the
I
hell? That you should be.
yeah, it's because I love poetry. It's because I because I that's what I love more than anything else is to read poetry, and that what a great poet can do, Seamus Heaney in one page, right? like get to the heart of something, to the deeper than most prose writers can in a thick chapter, you know. And so that is my standard, you know, is what can I do with less words to convey this in the way that my poet heroes do, because those are the things that move me the most, you know. If I had the skills to be a poet, I would be, but I never will be. So I'm, you know, but I that's my aspiration.
I mean, you have a poetic ear. It's not poetry, but you have an ear for like detail and dialogue where it just kind of pops out, and then it's like, okay, and when, like I've said, I'm just going to leave it here, and there's no excess at all.
A friend of mine reading the book, he wrote me, he's been writing me, and he's the harshest, one of the harshest critics I know. So, but he's like, I like page 259, but you carried it too much far on 149 or whatever he says. He's like, constantly at me with page numbers. So that is what I'm trying to do. It's just trying to get something within, you know, not go too far. But even in my short sections, sometimes apparently I go too far, and it's fair. It's a fair.
Huh.
I love that. I love to be, if I can be concise, if I can be more concise, I will be.
When you're like writing a draft of something, do you ever just like write like 20 pages of stuff and like, okay, I gotta chop this down? Or do you really keep yourself to like, okay, this has been like, 800 words, that's a lot.
It's, I mean, I wish I was one of those people, like, you know, like shitty first draft or whatever, you know, where you could write 800. It's like blood from a stone, you know. So I tend to be really slow, and I tend to just kind of like,
Sentence by sentence.
And so I, you know, but even there, I can write too much, and so I will compress it down. But I'm not somebody who has ever been able to produce a lot of words. I wish I could. It would make my life a lot easier and more enjoyable. But I've everything is hard for me in that way.
You evoke so much of, that old Chicago, most of which is before my time too. But I remember as a kid, like going to with my cousin, because they were members of the Standard Club, and I think we swam there clothed. But I remember like that kind of musty feeling of it that you evoked. And there are a lot of, old time Chicago people who are gonna, gobble this up. Are you hearing from them about what, about how you evoked Chicago, but also maybe specifically your observations about Essie and Cup, and whether it's family members or just like people who knew him? Like, do you
Sure.
get feedback like that?
I am hearing. I mean, you know, this is you always my philosophy, and my heroes are Chekhov and Joyce. They are local people. They wrote locally, you
Right.
know, wrote locally, and therefore, and somehow the rest of the world became interested. And I've always sort of gone by that idea: is the more local you are, no matter what you're writing about. My first novel was set in Namibia. Back there is Namibian country, you know, and I tried to be as specific and as local as I could possibly be there. In this novel, this is home. This is where I was born. This is where I grew up, and so I wanted to be hyper specific. I think some people are like, this is too specific. This is if I don't if you and I feel like if people are saying, well, I don't know Chicago, I can't connect with this book, then I've failed, right?
I think
Because,
you know Chicago because you read the book.
well,
You.
you know, I hope, you know, I hope. But there has been people like, well, you know, and Chicago sometimes can be a tough sell for, I don't know, people in Brooklyn or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it's sometimes it's like, and I think like the more provincial, the better, even though I make the joke at the beginning about provincial celebrities through Chekhov. But I so but to answer your question, yeah, I've been hearing from people who were roommates with Cookie here, and you know, all sorts of things I've been hearing. And you know, and I grew up with this stuff, though. I mean, my parents knew Cookie. They were, you know, a little bit older than she was. And so but yeah, I if people, because they know the story or know Cups, are engaged, I'll take that too. But I'll also very much welcome people who have no idea what this is about, and hopefully draw them in. That's my ultimate goal, but it was inevitable, if the book reached anybody, that I was going to hear from people who are familiar with the world, and I'm thrilled to be hearing from people, and most of it is very supportive.
So you're happy to get that kind of feedback, even if it's like, well, Essie was not like that, or what? I mean,
Yeah,
I'm not
no,
saying that she was, or I'm not saying she was or not. I'm just wondering,
right. I'm
just
sure.
thinking that part of you is just like, the work is the work, leave me alone, and then part of you is like, no, because it's rooted in everyone's world here, so.
Right. And again, it's fair game. I brought this on myself by doing it. But what I tried to do, even though I could be a little bit harsh on the cups, and I tried to see tried to create a world that was believable and also respectful of the real people. And I hope I did that, and that's not for me to judge, but I came to sort of love these people, even though they were very, very flawed, and I saw them as fictional creations off of the reality of who they were, which again is fair game for people who are well known,
Right. Yeah, I came out of this feeling like I could smell Cup's cigar breath.
Right. Well,
Like I know exactly what that smelled like.
right. I mean, that's very, very kind to say, and I'm sure, and again, I just want people to feel it. I want you to feel it if you know it, and I want you to feel it if you don't know it. And if you don't feel it, if you don't feel some level of emotion, then I've failed. And that is the risk that any fiction writer takes.
Could you have written this book if you were actually living in Chicago, as opposed to, like, now you're a professor at Dartmouth, you've been other places. I think you were in San Francisco, but you've sort of come into Chicago for like intensive experiences where you're, immersing yourself in it, and then not being here when you're writing it, I assume. Is that helpful to write about it, as opposed to if you were just here all the time?
I think it probably is. I God knows I wish I lived at home. And I come back to Chicago, and the northern suburbs any chance I can get. And it's more home than anywhere else, even though I love where I live now. I'm sitting in Vermont as we speak. But I think there's probably something to what you say. The distance was I was able to kind of create a mythical Chicago in my mind. That I didn't have to sort of contend with what's happening in Chicago at this given moment. So I was able to imagine my way back to 1963 or 1975 or 1983 is actually a key year in the book in terms of just what happens to my characters. So I think it was probably helpful to not be living in Chicago, but if I had my choice, I'd come back in a minute.
So you would still like to move back here if you could at some
Sure,
point.
someday.
There you go. And you're running the creative writing program at Dartmouth, is that right?
I'm chair of the English and Creative Writing Department.
Right. So you're reading a lot of students' fiction.
Sure.
My impression, but I want to know the actual answer, is that I imagine there's a lot of like world building and auto fiction. But that's just my sort of impression, having kids who are like of that age also. Like, tell me from your point of view, I mean, you've been writing for a long time. What are the students writing, and how do you kind of try to guide them, and what do you see happening in fiction from the younger people?
Well, I mean, my overriding message or goal or whatever it is like I said earlier, is like you gotta get your reader to feel something. And whether it's a fantastical universe with robots who are fighting each other, or if it's whatever else I sometimes see in the especially in the fantasy realm, it's not my go-to. It's not what I read. And I always come clean with the students and say, like, look, if you're gonna write in world building fantastical worlds, don't forget that unless there's an emotional core, unless you're reaching a reader, to me that's what fiction is about. And so, if you're gonna make me a movie on the page that has no characterizations, no soul, just a bunch of fighting, forget it. I don't want to watch that movie either. So, I'm always saying, like, look, if you do write whatever it is that you want, right? But don't forget that the goal of this is to make people feel a human feeling, you know.
Right.
And you know, and for the most part, my students are fantastic and get that message no matter what they're doing. And I have, it runs the gamut, you know. So I don't necessarily see, like, I mean, I see some trends and some speculative and, like you say, world building, that word comes up a lot. You know, to me, any writer has to build a world. That's
sure.
That's just it, you know. So
you built a world in you know, the Gospel Columnist's daughter. I mean, yeah, you built a world of this, you know, mythical, you know, old Chicago, you know, totally, which is based on fact, but you had to make it real for the reader.
But it existed only in my head. And, you know, and for some people it might think like, oh, you know, the guy got it wrong, whatever. But, you know, to me it is, you know, when you have to contain something within a few pages, it's never gonna be, it's a construct. It's a, you know, it's not a documentary film, you know. And so you have to make choices in order to create these worlds. And I think world building is what any writer has to do. But yeah, I do see a lot of stuff that is, like, you know, kind of more inspired by Marvel than I would like. Sure. Yeah. Or whatever, not necessarily Marvel, but fantasy series.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, again, yeah, I mean, whether it's Harry Potter or the other, a lot of dystopian stuff out there. But yeah, because, and look, anything, I mean, I have two kids, and anything that gets them to write is great. But sometimes I'm like, you know, write about something that sort of has an emotional core, like what you were saying, because it'll be so elaborate in the setup. And then, you know, I'll read it and then I'll try to be like supportive, but I'm also like, it's a lot of, you know, things are moving around, but I want to know the people.
And like you said, like I always want to encourage this rather than, you know what I mean?
Sure.
You know,
absolutely.
I can work with anybody who wants to use, you know, words on a page to create something in people's heads. That's a really hard thing, you know, to begin with. But I'm with you. I need characters, and I need them to be, you know, flesh and blood, you know, and as complicated as people are, I would like to see that on the page. And it's not easy. It's a very hard thing to ask of people. It's not easy for me. It's not easy for my students.
So, and with you, when something's set in an actual place, then you'll do something like come back to Chicago and walk from the north side out to Waldheim Jewish Cemetery. That's a schlep, as we would say.
It was actually a beautiful day for me. It was, I had just in my own head and my own thoughts, and I just kept wandering south and west to get out to Waldheim from somewhere off Irving Park. But I love that sort of tactile, you know, there's the character, Jed, the narrator of the book, he lives on West Pratt, and his ex-partner and kid live on Jarvis Street. I guess it's about a mile and something, maybe.
Yeah, no, I know. It's Rogers Park.
Yeah.
Rogers Park. It sounds like it's more West Rogers Park than by the lake. Rogers Park.
Yeah. Sort of, you know, a little bit west.
Around Ridge or something.
Yeah, exactly. And you go under the L tracks. And anyway, it was more like not to, I mean, I did want to get it, make it exact in that case, because Jed was so, so mourning, or, you know, a little bit in grief over what was happening to his personal life, that he was sort of being very specific about how many streets it took to get to see his daughter. But I think more than that, I would work while I was walking, you know, and just being in the neighborhood and being in the atmosphere, helped me a lot. So I have fond memories of working on this. I mean, I don't know about you, Mark, but when you finish something, it's kind of like it goes off and it has a life of its own. But when I was doing it, when I was in it, I had no idea if it was even going to ever be a book, but I had a certain amount of joy in kind of making it. And it's a little, that joy goes away when you're.
Yeah. So you're like, I need to walk between these two apartments, because that's what he would have been doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And then at some point you had the idea that he was going to walk out to Waldheim, so you just did it, or you started walking and you're like, hey, I think Jed's going to do this.
Yeah, well, Solly in the book is the character who walks to...
Right, Solly does it.
see his parents at Waldheim, and so I just wanted to do it myself and sort of see how that went. Like you said, it was a schlep, wasn't always a but it was always interesting. Chicago was never boring, and Sally says something to the effect of, you can experience a city by going west, and I sort of wanted to kind of work with that idea that sometimes my orientation tends to be east towards the lake, right? When I think about home, I think about the lake, but the city grows west, and south and east, I mean south and north obviously too, but yeah, I just wanted to like physically tactilely just kind of almost kind of trick myself into trying to get it on the page by doing it myself. It doesn't mean I could do it, but it was just a way of tricking myself. Like, oh, I'm doing research here, right? And then so.
But it all counts for something.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, my mom had a and two of her friends wrote a walking tours or walking good walks in Chicago book
Oh,
called
yeah.
The Lake is Always East.
Ah,
So
nice, nice.
I think that phrase shows up because it's not, original to them, but I was just like, yep.
Yeah.
Lake is always east, you're heading west, Solly's heading
How
west.
you know where you are, and I'm in Vermont. I have no idea what's northeast. It's like weird, but when I'm in Chicago, I know where I am.
When you're working on the getting the book outside of things and you're dealing with your agent or your editors or publishers, I mean, does everyone pretty much understand like this is the kind of writer you are and this is what you do, and there's no kind of pushback of like, well, how are we going to sell this, or do you actually have to get involved in that side of it?
I mean, I've been very lucky and blessed to have editors who get what I'm trying to do and don't try and force me to be somebody I'm not. And so I feel like I've been lucky in that way. I am sometimes asked that question, like how do you kind of get away with what you're doing? And I appreciate it because it's like, oh, maybe it's a little different, but I've just been lucky in the sense that people leave me alone to do what I do, and I know that that's not everybody's experience in publishing, and I'm just grateful that I've had those people to encourage me. Pat Strawn was my editor for many years, Ben George, great editor, and now Josh Kendall at Little Brown, fantastic editor. And just, these are people who let me do what I do and say like, all right, this works. I mean, they certainly push back when they think something doesn't work. But in general, people haven't minded my short chapters and my sort of way of building things that aren't linear.
Right. And your main character in here, Jed, who's also a writer, he sounds more frustrated than you. Like he sounds more like you sort of like, I have to give him, I can't have him be sort of like, oh, he's experimenting successfully. And
Yeah, no, Jed's a mess. He's a mess. I mean, he's an alter ego of some sort, but he's a real mess, and he's, his it, I was thinking, our personal lives always sort of affect us in every possible way, right? And so wouldn't they affect what we research? Wouldn't they affect the work that we're creating? Of course they do. And so in Jed's case, his life has fallen apart, and what has he got? He's got this old family story. That's what he's got. It's all he's got right now. He might have something else tomorrow.
And Rudy.
Yeah, and the cat, right? And so that was sort of my reigning idea, is like, okay, this guy's he just doesn't have much. And like, when you're depressed, when you are going through something, you may have a lot of friends, you may have a job that you enjoy, but the enjoyment lessens in the job, and maybe you don't want to see your friends, but like maybe just something you hold on to, And so in this case, he's holding on to, a story in his head about the death of a young woman, in 63, he was 22, and somebody who just that he'd heard about, and he kind of almost falls in love with from a distance of decades.
I think it takes a certain confidence as a writer for you to make a writer the protagonist of this book with all these like obvious actual family parallels, but to make him so much of a mess, even knowing that people are going to think, oh, people are going to think this guy is me. Because so you just have to be able, like, obviously you have to be like, yeah, I don't, you know, I'm fine with that. That's what comes with the territory.
Yeah, in this case, I mean, I don't think I've ever had a writer protagonist of any story, as far as I can recall. But I've certainly written nonfiction, so I can be in that space because I'm pretending, obviously, to write nonfiction here. You know, through Jed, who's ostensibly writing his family history, right? And so I resisted a long time having him be a writer. And at a certain point, I think a friend of mine was just like, you know what? Just like, maybe just, you know, just own it. Just, you know, because I was testing it out, the idea that this was a writer writing the book. And, you know, I resisted it. And I just thought, you know what? If that's the way to get this done, to kind of have it be someone else doing it, i.e. the, in this case, Jed, then okay, then let him be a writer. And, you know, writers are, we're also part of the human race. You know what I mean? We, you know, so like the idea that you can't have a writer be the protagonist is obviously ridiculous, but it's like, but I think it's something that shouldn't be done that much. It's like, you know, talking about your dreams, you just don't want to do it, right? So I was like very resistant. And then I was like, you know what? I surrender. Jed's going to write this book about his family. And come on, man.
Well, like I'm reading like Chris Borelli's piece where he's interviewed you and is writing about the book and saying it's like the best book of the year, period, not just the best Chicago book. I mean, he loves the book, but he's also sort of drawing these conclusions about like these sort of parallels between you and Jed. And I was reading it going, I don't know about that. Like, I don't know whether, you know, this sort of, I mean, you could tell me, but sort of the frustration of the lack of fame or whatever Jed seems to carry more than I feel like you do, but maybe you do. And you just sort of don't want to talk about it.
I've made jokes in fiction. It's not the first time that I've had a character. I guess I said I haven't written about a writer. Now I'm thinking of one particular story where I make a joke from that angle. And so, you know, exactly. I do not have the same feelings about my, you know, my work and life as Jed has. And, you know, but again, I'll take whatever it takes to get people engaged
right.
in a story. If I have to, like, it's almost like if I have to sacrifice my own body to do it, I'll do it. You know what I mean? But no, Jed is not me. He's not me. But sure, had I, you know, and I think Christopher Borelli, and God love him, and the piece was terrific, and I'm incredibly grateful. But yeah, the conflation between me and the fictional character is, you know, maybe a little bit more than the reality.
One of the things that always sort of got me, you know, Ezra, whether it was stuff on the Tribune back in the day when you'd be on the train and people would actually be reading on right. the train, and you'd see them reading the thing you wrote, and you're like, oh, that's cool. You know, or I'm sure you've seen people reading things that you've written, and you certainly know that people are reading what you've written. Like, is that just kind of what it's all about? Is like sort of knowing that your voice is in someone else's head and, you know, in their bed or their chair or their comfortable couch or wherever they are. Like there's just something about it. I'm sort of rambling now, but I feel like part of the joy of being a writer is knowing that someone's spending time with you and your thoughts, even when you don't know it.
Yeah, no, I think you put it so beautifully. I mean, you know, it's a very lonely thing we do, you know, when we're by ourselves and we have these people in our heads doing things. And, you know, why do we do this? I think we want to, it's a weird way of reaching people without having, without like, it's like a communion kind of thing, you know, in silence. And I've always sort of just, you know, the few people that read my stuff in the past and the people who read this book now, I am just thrilled by the idea that we're sort of talking, you know,
right.
over the transom, you know. And I think it's a kind of a beautiful thing to think of, you know, that you reach people and maybe make them laugh or make them feel something. And I, you know, does the world need more novels? I think so. You know, I think so, you know.
Sure.
And I think that's what it is. I think it, you know, I'm not naive enough to think like that novels sort of like make anybody a better person or create empathy or anything like that. But I think it is there is a kind of communion, is kind of a connection that I think is why writers write and why readers read. There's a weird, you know, kind of symbiosis, if that's even a word, that happens.
Sure. Absolutely. When you let go of this one, did you immediately plunge into something else, or do you have to sort of take time to figure it out?
I mean, it's been a while since this book has been done, you know, so, you know, but when a book's like in that liminal space of not being out yet, just so like, you know, your brain sort of can't quite, at least my brain can't focus. I have trouble focusing anyway, but I'm working on a couple of new things now and I'm trying to move forward, and, you know, and think of this in the rearview mirror, but again, it's nice to know that people are reading, and your reading is, it was so generous of the book. And so it's been fun. It's fun to talk about.
Do you finish a novel and think, okay, now I'm going to do a short story, or now I'm going to do another kind of musing about, you know, like some nonfiction, you know, collection of my thoughts or whatever. I mean, I don't know what you would call Am I Alone Here, which was another wonderful book, but not fiction. Like, do you sort of think I need to shift gears now? Or like, what's been tugging on you since then?
I mean, this is my third novel. They take me a long time, and I always sort of have one big project that's going on. But my, one of my great loves is to write, you know, very short stories, and that's what I'm back to, and I'm happy to be doing that, and hopefully there'll be a book out of that at some point.
Nice. Well, I look forward to it. I can't wait to read that, to see you here. We got through this whole thing and I didn't bring up Camp Nabagaman once. it's the best place to clear your head. And people were like, did you get writing done? And I'm like, you know what? I didn't. I always think I'm gonna, but then I just sort of go and jump in the lake instead.
No, but I think about it later, you know? Like some of my early stories were set in Iron River and Duluth and stuff. And I camp was so hugely, I mean, it's like the most important thing. I mean, it saved my life, basically. I mean, it really did. I think I would have, who knows what I would have done without it. Just without getting that job and without having this great boss, EJ Hahn, who I'm sure you knew at one point. EJ was just incredibly huge figure in my life. I've written about him in the story I alluded to, about the writer. It's a cab driver / writer story, and EJ is the
which collection is that in?
It's in Maggie Brown, and it's a
so I've read it. Yeah,
it's called Ineffectual Tribute to Len, and it is a story really a tribute to the idea of EJ, because he really just kind of plucked me, and he said, "Look, you're not as much of a dumb shit as you might think," you know. And he was the best thing that ever happened.
That's all for episode 196 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Peter Orner for opening up about his adventures in old Chicago and the blurry fact fiction line, and his knack for picking the right words. The Gossip Columnist's Daughter has been published by Little Brown and Company and is widely available. I encourage you to dig into his short story collections, Esther Stories, Last Car Over the Sagamore Bridge, and Maggie Brown and Others, as well as his novels, including Love and Shame and Love, and essay collections, including Am I Alone Here?, Notes of Reading to Live and Living to Read. You'll enjoy having his voice in your head. Go to peterorner.com for more information about him and his work. He's also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter X. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who, like me, never appeared in Cup's column, though Peter Orner did. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.